This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, from the studios of the Library of Congress, with Indran Amirthanayagam. And he's our guest from the Diplomatic Corps to the Sphere of Poetry. He will tell you who he is by what he writes. So let's hear what you write, Indran.
Thank you. Flying Rose. I miss you is a bit of a non sequitur. What I know and do not need to say, yet feel compelled to name, to get the raw emotion out into fresh air, to see if it curls towards the light or turns back shriveling a petrified, dry, brittle rose. The end of all bouquets, unless another bunch puts on its clothes to fly to where my heart must go.
Indran Amirthanayagam. I didn't put any extra syllables in this,
no,
time.
No.
Tell us about this new book and where your heart goes in it, and why are they sonnets?
It's called White Space Sonnets. You know, I'm filling the white space of the page with these musical word structures, which I call sonnets. I'm very thrilled to join the great tradition of sonneteering. But I do it my own way, I suppose. I mean, I call them free verse sonnets. They follow certain patterns, the 14 lines, usually the volta or the turn on the eighth line or ninth line. And then and there are rhymes and there are meters and a certain attention to sound. But I don't want to shackle the poem to a strict pattern that's imposed, in a sense. So I write in the tension between the free and the imprisoned, you know, trying to make the poem sing in that space.
Right. And what do you think you're saying in this book?
Well, I published this book far away from America, my new home, in my old home in Ceylon, in Sri Lanka. And I did that very deliberately because I wanted to write a book that was available to the Sri Lankan readers. And I went back there in December to launch the book. And it was a thrill to see this book in the bookshops there in Colombo and to share the poems to local audiences in English, which is one of the languages of Sri Lanka.
Wonderful. And the book is about love, war, and love. Give us two poems, Indran. This is the Poet and the Poem.
Back on stage. If this turn on stage finished right now, I would say, wow, what a performance. One I could not have imagined born in the transit lounge, spun out to the center of the city, paved with gold, hurled across oceans to the isles of some other human's paradise that became my own. Just like the original, the greatest gift migration gives, to adapt, to put on new clothes, to own them and to go on whistling despite the blows of the packy-bashing brigade or the snooty fellow running the old society who says, what kind of American is this? Mm. Your kind, my friend, made of steel like steelers, fashioned in ore from a Massachusetts ironworks. I'm not speaking foolishness. Every American image is mine to use, the gift of leaves of grass, of absolute openness.
Mm.
And another poem from the first section called Fawn in Light. Light the candle when you wake. It will shine in the haze, help you make your way to wash, to dress, to prepare for the greater light of day. Or if the sun pauses behind a cloud for a few hours of grey, do not worry. Light you carry in heart and mind will warm and direct you to put melancholy away in a book written a long time ago, up on your shelf. Consult it when you wish, just to know it has been overcome, made ink on paper, healed in verse, printed in past time. Now you have new light to guide, fawn ahead in the wood, looking at you with curious, wondrous eyes.
Beautiful ending. I would like everyone to know that you are a poet, editor, publisher, translator, musician, YouTube host, and former U.S. diplomat. and you've published more than 30 books and translations, and you write in English, Spanish, French, Portuguese, and Haitian Creole. This is all true. He is just a master of languages. And if you read this book, you'll get to see a little bit about how he got to be the way he is and what he thinks. White Space Sonnets. How many countries were you in while you were in the diplomatic corps? Or how many countries did you serve?
I must have served in at least 7 countries. And close to home, close to in America, I served in Canada and in Mexico. I served in Peru and Argentina, and I served also in the African continent, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Europe, in Belgium, and in India, close to my original home. So I traveled the world as a diplomat, but I wanted to follow the path of another diplomat poet, Pablo Neruda. Now, when Neruda became a diplomat for Chile, he landed in my island of Ceylon. And when I discovered that, I thought of developing a career and I could end up in Chile. I never actually got to Chile to serve as an American diplomat, but I served in Argentina and in Peru and neighboring countries. Something about serving in this continent means a lot to me. And for me, America is much grander than the United States. It includes all of the countries that you find here, from Canada down to Tierra del Fuego, you know, and you have the Caribbean nations, also American nations. The concept of America is a concept that I also learned in poetry from Walt Whitman, and I mentioned Leaves of Grass in this one of these poems. So it's a broad, open border.
What is the most important thing you learned about yourself after living in all these countries? When you look back, what is the one thing that gave you self-knowledge? What insight do you have about yourself after mingling with all these people? That you were nicer than you thought? That you were more competent than you were thought? What is the difference between now and then?
Whatever the slings and arrows you face as a human being, you can resist them and wake up the next day into the light and go walking, you know, and keep walking. Walking across borders, not only physical borders, but imaginary, psychological, philosophic borders. Walk into other languages and make yourself at home. You know, there's a custom that's, I think, universal, that you give bread and water to the stranger who comes. And so becoming that stranger and sitting at the table of the host and speaking and learning and sharing what you have learned on the journey, and all of that, because we are all on journeys wherever we are, whether we stay at home or we are on the road.
Well, what do you think then of the human condition when you look at all those countries? What gives you hope or what gives you fear?
What gives me hope is that the sun is still around and lighting up the morning, no matter what happens in the night, no matter what happens to your family, to your friends. We have to take that light and spread it. That's what I think a poet does, is a kind of a preacher sharing light in dark times and in dark places. Mm. And there are dark times, and we're living through dark times. But I was born in an island that suffered a horrific civil war. I call it an uncivil war in one of my books. And it lasted 26 years in some sense, but one could say it lasted more than the life I've spent so far on the planet. My poetry comes from that war. It comes from the migration away from that war. And it comes from love, because love is the gift that I learned from my parents. It's the gift that I learned from faith and from loving and crossing the border between two humans, you know, whether...
That's the border. That's the border. Yes, Indran Amirthanayagam is here with us, and he has won the Patterson Prize, and he has the 2000 IFLAC World Poet Prize. The Patterson Prize was Elephants of Reckoning, if I'm right.
That's right. Yeah.
You write a weekly poem for Haiti on Marche and El Cento. And you are the Matwala Poet of Honor. What is that?
It's a title, the Matwala Organization, which is a wonderful organization promoting poetry and crossing borders between different poetry cultures, that they gave me last year just to honor the work I do as a poet and as an editor over many decades now.
Translator, musician, give us two more Indran poems.
I will, and I'm reading from White Space Sonnets, which was published in Sri Lanka by Sarasavi, but I hope one day to publish an American edition. From the war section, the war in this case is the war on Ukraine, and this poem comes from the early days of that invasion. To Guinea with love. The tradesman from Guinea has lived in Odessa for 14 years. He's afraid. In one day, all of Ukraine's airports shut down. In one night, heavy bombs fell just outside of town. They're falling now. Russian soldiers landed on the beach and are marching towards Kyiv. The horror, the sadness, it is happening. Shock and awe, awful wrath, madness, Chernobyl, symbol of nuclear death, captured. No reports yet on the state of the concrete. Where are we going? I listen to the trembling voice of my friend from Guinea. He says he will watch and wait for another day or two, huddle at home by his television in the apartment block. If fighting comes to his neighborhood, then he will call Guinea, ask to be flown out. How many diplomats has Guinea posted in Ukraine? How many cars and planes? Airports are shut, but the sea flows by Odessa. Our tradesman has lived there for 14 years. He knows people with boats. He has sold them houseware. He will ask them to take him away past the battleships to Guinea. And that's a poem written from the news, from the story of this tradesman from Guinea who was stuck in Odessa and now exploding able. You know, all my life I've been fascinated by this story of Cain and Abel.
I was going to say, their poems are so layered that we'd love it for you to set them up for us ahead of time because they've got so many levels.
Thank you. I mean, in this case, Exploding Abel, the one I will read now, has to do with that murder, that first murder, you know. Why did Cain kill his brother? I'm still trying to understand that, and why do I carry the mark of Cain on my forehead? I mean, I've grown up with this idea that I have this guilt somehow that I have to expiate, I have to root out. The guilt of leaving the original island, the paradise, but is it really a paradise when blood is spilled irrationally, when damage is done to the ecosystem irrationally? You know, it can happen anywhere, and it applies to everywhere. You know, this kind of contradictory impulse in the human heart or human soul to murder and to create. You know, I mean, William Blake caught on that in his Songs of Innocence and Experience. And here, this poem is called Exploding Abel. Cain is killing Abel again and again, but his blood is flowing in real time on 1,000,000,000 screens. This invasion cannot be hidden, just like the stain on the forehead, which does not protect the killer, despite God's intention, from the global revulsion and desire for vengeance. This Cain will be hounded and punished. He will not survive, not in any corner of the globe where people are studying the photographs, memorizing the exact imprint of the scar. To make sure when they exercise the citizen's right, they will not commit a crime. They will not kill the wrong family member. In Mariupol, a theater housing 1,000 women, children, and men was hit by a high-performance bomb. Mm. Nobody knows how many are walking out of the ruins, how many Abels need justice from that one building in one city of Ukraine. Just the notion of a high-performance bomb, can you imagine? Can we imagine?
We cannot. Amir Thanayagam has had fellowships from the Foundation for the Arts, the New York Foundation for the Arts, the U.S.-Mexico Fund for Culture, and the McDowell Colony. You know, your life is informed by migration and immigration. Your work, your passion, your sense of justice. You might consider yourself still an immigrant in this adopted country. What does displacement mean in the modern world? And in the history of the world, what is the biggest meaning for immigration?
I have a book in Spanish called In Busca de Posada. Posada is that manger where, you know, the family went. I grew up in a Catholic tradition, so and a Christian tradition. I have the story of Jesus is very ingrained in me. And, you know, Jesus being born in a manger because it could not find a place, an inn that would take them in, the family. But for me, it's very, very important to find refuge, to find a home. My original home, Ceylon, no longer exists. It's been renamed Sri Lanka. Perhaps one can't go home again, but at the same time, I have been blessed by immigration, blessed learning different languages, living in different cultures, and feeling at home, and being made to feel at home, being allowed to feel at home in these languages, in these cultures. Mm. It's just an experience, a very positive experience that I've had living the 60-odd years I've lived on the planet. And it means that I want to share that joy of arrival with readers, with listeners, with friends. The joy of arrival and the learning that comes from arrival, and learning to, even though you have to live with that nostalgia for that original home, or you, and sometimes a sense of sadness, trying to cope with the loss, you can do it. You can cope with that loss, and you can transform yourself. You can become a new person, reborn as a migrant.
You're anonymous every time. But, you know, you did have the value of survival mechanisms.
Yes.
And that, of course, has been removed. That removes a great burden from you, that you did have enough to eat, you knew where to sleep.
Right.
So, but still, you're saying that it is, displacement is really a physical thing for the whole body and the mind and the emotions. And you say there is something that can be taken out of that which is good, even in adverse conditions.
Even in adverse conditions, you survive, and then you start to thrive. Look, I cannot say that my story applies to everyone. Yesterday I was in a taxi, and the driver had crossed all of America on foot and boat, crossed through the Darien Gorge in Panama, and had arrived in the United States, and is now was granted asylum here. And the stories he told me about that journey, the skeletons he found along the way, the negotiations he had to make in order to get to the next stage, incredible.
Write that up for us.
Yeah.
Please write that up for us, because we have to put a face on it. I know I had the same taxi driver in Florida who told me, please write my story of my uncle Vladimir, who was put on the bus and beaten and dropped off in Mexico with no money. We have to write their stories, because sometimes it's very hopeful. Let us have two more poems.
Pleasure.
I'm interested in Haiti. When you were there, was it before the collapse of the country?
Yes. I mean, I was there from 2014 to 2017. And, you know, Haiti has gone through many political crises, and right now it's in a very hurting place because of the control of much of the capital city by these gangs. And yet there is hope there, and the country is preparing for new elections after a 10-year absence. Haitians have taught me the resilience and hope. You know, the coin is romanticism on one side and cynicism on the other. I think the cynic disappears when facing adversity and overcoming it. And I think the Haitian people need to be honored and celebrated. I talk about Haitian Creole. Why not make Creole a universal language of the United Nations? I mean, why does the United Nations have English, French, Spanish, Chinese, and Russian? Yeah, and the Russian. But there's no Haitian Creole, there's no Portuguese, there's no Tamil. The world can only be made a better place and a more multiple place, and in the field of languages as well.
Well said, well said. Did you actually work with people as a diplomat?
I did.
Not paper.
Yeah, I was very interested in living and working with the people, and in a way, and leaving the separate state of, you know, the diplomat, the elite diplomat hidden in a 4x4 bulletproof car going through the streets. I walked on the streets. I did a couple of things that were against our own rules, I must admit.
I believe it with all my heart. No kidding. Knowing you.
But doing that made all the difference.
It's
like the road not taken, you know, that makes all the difference in frost, you know.
Let us have. Let us have a lot of poems. Let's have two more.
Well, here's one that I'm concerned about only because of the notion of the, what is a book, you know, and what survives? The Rare Book Hunter's Dilemma. As long as one copy of the poetry book exists in a house somewhere on the planet, the potential for reproduction cannot be dismissed, termed academic. Verses can print again, the author or owner of the aforementioned property, a friend, pay attention to place the order before the unexpected storm raises the river to flood its banks, to roar down the road, to fill the basement and keep going up to the top shelf where the rarest first editions are kept, away from peering eyes or rare book hunters who would benefit from keeping the books rare. Each one of a kind.
Where are all your 30 books?
I still have one copy of each at home. I'm hoping to keep that conserved from the flood when it comes.
And they're all over the world?
They are in many different parts of the world. I don't know if they're in the Soviet
Union.
How many
languages are they in?
Five languages. French, Spanish, Portuguese, English, and Haitian Creole.
And which are you better, which is your prosody, your best prosody?
I'm very happy in Spanish and in Portuguese and in English. And English is still my strongest language in the sense that I can wake up muttering and I can sort of stumble to the desk and write a line in English. But honestly, I am so in love with the languages I've learned growing up, including, you know, Spanish and Portuguese, and now I'm studying some Italian, hoping that one day I'll learn enough to speak. I'll admit I've actually translated from Italian into English because I can, using dictionaries and knowing the other. And I have a manuscript of an Italian poet. I'm hoping that will.
You have a Mediterranean platform too, of root language.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So I'm feeling good.
Do you dream in English?
I do. I dream in Spanish too. I'm not kidding. I've dreamt in each of these languages, and it's been my blessing. It's a blessing. I feel at home when I dream in the language. I feel like I've somehow arrived, and that I know the name of the bread in that language.
That's
you know?
A great line. Do you have that in one of your books?
No,
I know the name of the bread. In each language. That is so fundamental, so organic. Let's keep on going. Give us another poem.
It comes from talking with you, Grace, and I can't resist. I have a poem here that's called Driving with Grace.
but it better be complimentary.
It goes like this. And if there's time, I'll read one more. Driving with Grace. I was driving through the beating rain, sliding across highway pools, keeping both hands on the steering wheel, hoping the right front tire would hold after the whiplash from the flatbed truck. I was driving with faith in God's blessing that my car would manage the journey from Saratoga Springs to Washington, that despite buckets slamming, slathering, sloshing, I would come out alive, drive to the customary spot on the driveway, that I would gather my suitcase and bag of books and walk to the front door to say to my mum, I had an accident, but I survived, and I'm back after the long journey, together again, thanks to a forklift from Grace.
Well, you are my forklift, you know, forklift, that's a metaphor for our radio program, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. You know, I want to know about Endrin as a little boy. You say Ceylon. And I want to know what the surroundings were when you were five, what it looked like, what it smelled like, what it tasted like, how you perceived the world as a little boy. Who was this little boy? Do you know him? Do you recognize him? Tell us about it.
I loved cricket as a little boy. I would run around, go around the house with a cricket bat, imagining myself at Lord's in London hitting a century, which is a big achievement in the game of cricket. I love mangosteens and mangoes and rambutans, and these are the fruits of the island. And I loved chilies. I would eat raw hot chilies as a kid. I thought that was a sign of being valiant and strong. And I loved the pungent spices and the deep sweet fruits and the beach and the prawns, the giant prawns. Everything was big as a child for me. The prawns were what we call shrimp, but were huge. The fish, it's a fish culture, Ceylon, Sri Lanka.
Is it still that beautiful?
It is, it is. Now, of course, in 1948, I was born in 1960. In 1948, the population was 8 million. Now it's about 20, 22 million or something. So there's more pressure on the ecosystem and jostling for nourishment. You know, whether you're an elephant, you have less space to roam, whether you're a human being. But it's still very, very
now,
beautiful.
What is the population now?
Around 22 million, I think.
I see.
And so you can see in that one ecosystem of the island of Sri Lanka, the growth of the human population. And there is a challenge, there is a tension. The human population wants to conserve the environment, but it also builds.
It needs it too.
Yeah. So.
But it's a fisherman society. Is that all there is?
No. It grows tea, a very important production of tea.
Of course,
in the highlands. There are rare semi-precious stones mining. There are different, but tourism is an important element of the economy. And there is, financial services. And there is some industry, but not heavy industry.
It's an island.
Yeah.
But you haven't mentioned a little boy reading books. Did a little boy read books?
I did. I used to. My father was a poet, a wonderful poet, and I remember hearing him recite Yeats, for example, out loud around the radio. He would do radio programs about poetry, and I would listen to them. I read books. I loved mystery stories. I love Enid Blyton and the Five Fine Doubters, and I was reading in English, but I was going to school in Tamil, and I was speaking Sinhalese as well.
What was your schoolroom like?
St. Joseph's College, it's called, in Darley Road in Colombo. There were old wooden desks and hard
so
to sit in chairs.
School. It was a
Catholic school. Private school, but not an expensive private school. I mean, there were all sorts of. There were students from all different kinds of economic backgrounds and so on. But I, a child of privilege, yes. My father did well. My mother, my grandfather started a printing company in Colombo, and he used to print the movie tickets and brochures for the first films on the island. So I came out of that culture.
You have good memories. Yeah. And let us have memory as a final poem.
All right. Let me see. Perhaps I'll read this one, Lifetime Subscription. Yeah. Every day, Every hour, every minute, when my bones become tired, although they carry my flesh without complaint, and my eyes see the morning light clearly after sleep, assisted by the apnea machine, when I stumble after an imaginary visit to the cemetery where bums are sitting on headstones with me drinking rye, after another disappointment in the rose-strewn field, after shouting across oceans, after damn perfect dissolution of order, driven by fear and anxiety about illness coursing through the fragile yet strong body of my daughter, the decline we know in our bones, the aches we feel, we subscribe to hope that tomorrow will bring some peace, along with new resolution to go ahead, even with caution, even afraid, to not look back, or we let the subscription expire. That poem ends on that line. I'm not letting the subscription expire.
That is the voice of Indran Amirthanayagam. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the studios of the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress and our funders, the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canavore, Ki-Yung Kim Renaud, Avide Shoshani, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.